CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be. Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure, Season 4 in American Tragedy. I'm your host, your friend, your ear lover, your literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black. Being very disciplined, now I normally like to record on Sundays, but sometimes it gets pushed into Monday, sometimes even into Tuesday, and that, of course, upsets our dear producer Robin tremendously, because it gives her less time to assemble the week's episode. And so I've been trying to be a little bit more disciplined about it. I've been good the last many weeks, but today I have to get it done because Martha's leaving town tomorrow. She's going to visit her brother, who's in Florida for a few weeks. She's going to drive down there, and then on Wednesday of this week, I have to go someplace to shoot. I'm shooting 2 days on a very big movie, and I'm not going to say what it is because I don't think I'm allowed to, because, you know, and they make you sign these NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, that you say you're not going to say nothing about nothing. So, you know, if I want my SAG minimum, I'm not going to say nothing about nothing. But it should be fun. Like I said, it's just a small part. But I do think it'll be fun. And I will say, by orders of magnitude, this will be the largest film in which I ever have appeared. And in terms of screen time, it is roughly analogous to the normal amount of screen time I get, which is to say very, very little. I don't care. The thing about the big movies, you know, and the reason that I was so happy to say yes when they asked me to do it is because, let's say a movie makes, I don't know, $100 million, $200 million, something like that. You got to think that the residual checks on something like that would be terrific, right? Like, I was in this movie called Sextuplets, starring Marlon Wayans, and it was never even in the theaters. It was just straight to Netflix. It was like one of those. It was like top 10 in Netflix for like a week or something. But every once in a while, I get like a nice little check from that, you know? So I'm hoping, more than anything, that is what results from this. Because you may not know this, but actors in the unions, we have to qualify for our health insurance every single year. So if you don't make enough money that year, you don't get health insurance. So the residuals do count towards health insurance. And that's a big deal, you know, because I'm not a young man. Let me correct myself. I'm a handsome young man, but chronologically speaking, if you're gonna play it straight, and fans of Mike and Tom Eat Snacks know I always play it straight. If you're gonna play it straight, you got to admit that my current age, which I think is 52, is, you know, advanced. It's an advanced age. Speaking of ages, let's take ourselves back to the waning days of the Gilded Age. The 1920s. I don't know if, I actually don't know if that's the waning days of the Gilded Age, but I wanted to incorporate the word age as a segue. And I know the Gilded Age is like the late 1890s into the early part of the 1900s. And I don't know if it quite encompasses this part, but I'm calling anything pre-Depression the Gilded Age, for lack of historical knowledge or the desire to crank up the old research machine. So we're going back to the Gilded Age, and Clyde Griffiths is on his way to Lycurgus, New York. I correct myself. He's in Lycurgus. Last episode, he made it to Lycurgus, and he was going to present himself at the collar-making factory, but he's got time. You know, there's no appointed hour when he needs to be there, so he's going to take himself a little stroll around Lycurgus, take a gander, see what's what, you know, get himself comfortable and acquainted with his surroundings, and then from there he'll go and start his job. Now, I was speculating last episode that it is this interlude that will provide him an opportunity to meet one of his cousins. My guess is it will be Maya, and he will fall head over heels for her and she for him, and then at some point, or no, Bella. Bella's the little one. And then Maya, at some point, will also become acquainted with Clyde. She will become jealous and murderous, and either she will kill her sister, or she will kill Clyde, or Clyde will kill her, or, I mean, I just need somebody to kill somebody. All right, so let's see if that happens in this episode of Obscure, although I think we both know it will not, seeing as we have another year and a half to go, most likely, before any substantive murders take place. I mean, if novelistic structure is to be followed. But let's pick it up again, why don't we, on Book 2, Chapter 24, In American Tragedy. But once in this, and walking about, how different it all seemed to the world to which so recently he had been accustomed. So he's up, he's walking around, and it looks a little different. Let's find out why. For here, as he had thus far seen, all was on a so much smaller scale. The depot, from which only a half hour before he had stepped down, was so small and dull, untroubled, as he could plainly see, by much traffic. And the factory section, which lay opposite the small city, across the Mohawk, was little more than a red and gray assemblage of buildings, with here and there a smokestack projecting upward and connected with the city by two bridges, a half dozen blocks apart, one of them directly at this depot, a wide traffic bridge across which traveled a car line, following the curves of Central Avenue, dotted here and there with stores and small homes. Yeah, if you've ever been to these upstate New York cities that used to be the hub of so much manufacturing, that's exactly right. They were cities, sure, but they were small cities, you know? And what am I thinking of here? Corning and Oneida and Syracuse and Utica and all these places where they just used to make stuff, you know? And then, I don't know what happened, manufacturing collapsed or went overseas, and all these towns just dried up. I used to live in one called Peekskill there on the Hudson, and this was in Upper Westchester County, and Peekskill, it used to make all kinds of stuff. I feel like cast iron was maybe one of their things, like cast iron stoves and such, but then, I don't know, it all dried up, and Peekskill went to hell. Which was good for me because it meant I could afford a house. It also meant I had to leave that community as soon as I had children of school age because the schools were bad. But Central Avenue, back in Lycurgus, was quite alive with traffic, pedestrians, and automobiles. Opposite diagonally from the hotel, which contained a series of wide plate glass windows, behind which were many chairs interspersed with palms and pillars, was the Dry Goods Emporium of Stark & Company, a considerable affair, four stories in height and of white brick, and at least 100 feet long, the various windows of which seemed bright and interesting, crowded with as smart models as might be seen anywhere. Also, there were other large concerns, a second hotel, various automobile showrooms, a moving picture theater. Well, it sounds like Lycurgus is hopping. And I do sort of like the idea of models in the window. I assume that means mannequins, just a word that probably hadn't come into fashion then, but the idea of like live models in the windows. Yeah, that's kind of cool, you know? Not a bad job. It reminds me, actually, of Mike Birbiglia. Once was a window model. He, you know, Mike Birbiglia, the comedian, he wrote a show called Sleepwalk With Me about his sleep problems. And then some company hired him to basically live in the window at Macy's for, I feel like, 5 days to promote some sort of sleep product. It might have been a bed or a mattress or something like that. And, you know, I think they paid him a fortune to do it. And then he was allowed to have visitors, so me and Michael Showalter went over there and hung out in the window with him for a little while. And, yeah, and that was that. He found himself ambling on and on until suddenly he was out of the business district again and in touch with a wide and tree-shaded thoroughfare of residences, the houses of which each and every one appeared to possess more room space, lawn space, general ease and repose and dignity even than any with which he had ever been in contact. In short, as he sensed it from this brief inspection of its very central portion, it seemed a very exceptional, if small, city street. Rich, luxurious even. So many imposing wrought iron fences, flower-bordered walks, grouped trees and bushes, expensive and handsome automobiles, either beneath porte-cochers within or speeding along the broad thoroughfare without. And you remember, of course, that automobiles, at this point and time in the nation's history, still, I would imagine, if not a rarity, then not an altogether fully common sight. Horses and buggies probably still, I would imagine, making up the majority of transportation in the nation, but I don't know. Maybe I'm mistaken. Well, you know what? Let's find out. I am going to crank up the old research machine and let's see. I don't even know. I'm actually going to ask ChatGPT. Okay, ChatGPT, how many automobiles were in the possession of United States customers in 1925. And ChatGPT's thinking about it. And it says, wow, that's quite, I gotta tell you, this is far more than I had thought. In 1925, approximately 17.5 million automobiles were registered in the United States, and that excludes an additional 2.5 million trucks. Well, let's find out what the population was. What was the United States population in 1925? Probably 100 million? Let's see if that. Approximately 115 million. So approximately 10%... of Americans owned automobiles or had an automobile in their household. So, all right. So it was, I think my initial assessment was actually more or less correct. They were becoming more common, but were still not the primary mode of transportation in the nation. All right. Now that that is settled, let us pick it up. And in some neighboring shops, those nearest Central Avenue and the business heart where this wide and handsome thoroughfare began, were to be seen such expensive-looking and apparently smart displays of the things that might well interest people of means and comfort: motors, jewels, lingerie, leather goods, and furniture. I like the idea that in shops of the time, you could be walking down the thoroughfare there and look in a shop window and you might see leather goods and furniture. And then in one shop window, there might just be motors. When was the last time you saw a motor in a shop window. I can't think of any times where I've seen that. But where now did his uncle and his family live? In which house? What street? Was it larger and finer than any of these he had seen in this street? He must return at once, he decided, and report to his uncle. He must look up the factory address, probably in that region beyond the river, and go over there and see him. What would he say? How act? What would his uncle set him to doing? What would his cousin Gilbert be like? What would he be likely to think of him? In his last letter, his uncle had mentioned his son Gilbert. He retraced his steps along Central Avenue to the depot and found himself quickly before the walls of the very large concern he was seeking. It was of red brick, 6 stories high, almost 1,000 feet long. It was nearly all windows, at least that portion which had been most recently added and which was devoted to collars. An older section, as Clyde later learned, was connected with the newer building by various bridges, and the south walls of both these two structures, being built at the water's edge, paralleled the Mohawk. There were also, as he now found, various entrances along River Street, 100 feet or more apart, and each one guarded by an employee in uniform. Entrances numbered 1, 2, and 3, which were labeled for employees only. An entrance numbered 4, which read office, and entrances 5 and 6 appeared to be devoted to freight receipts and shipments. All right, well, so we've got Clyde there circling the factory, taking its measure, doing some rough calculations as to its dimensions and size and its number of entrances and egresses. I guess I was wrong. I guess he's not going to meet his cousin right there as he ambles along Central Avenue. I don't like it when I'm wrong, but I do like to be surprised. Let's take a moment, have ourselves a break, and we shall return in a jiffy here on Obscure.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back on Obscure, Clyde Griffith's about to present himself to the Griffiths Collar Company proprietor, or perhaps the heir apparent Gilbert. We don't know, but Clyde has made his way to the factory, is inspecting it, and here he is. Clyde made his way to the office portion and, finding no one to hinder him, passed through 2 sets of swinging doors and found himself in the presence of a telephone girl seated at a telephone desk behind a railing, in which was set a small gate, the only entrance to the main office, apparently. and this she guarded. She was short, fat, 35, and unattractive. Again, we are equating, I'm just noticing again, we are equating shortness with unattractiveness. Just pointing that out. This seems to be a little fetish of drizers. Well, fetish may not be the right word, but it certainly is the most lascivious. All right. Well, she called as Clyde approached. I want to see Mr. Gilbert Griffiths, Clyde began a little nervously. What about? Well, you see, I'm his cousin. Clyde Griffiths is my name. I have a letter here from my uncle, Mr. Samuel Griffiths. He'll see me, I think. As he laid the letter before her, he noticed that her quite severe and decidedly indifferent expression changed and became not so much friendly as awed. For obviously, she was very much impressed, not only by the information, but his looks, and began to examine him slyly and curiously. Well, that's interesting. To me, anyway, the very first person he meets in Lycurgus, he drops the name Griffiths, opens his pockets, and retrieves a letter, and the next thing you know, he's being treated like a personage of great importance, and a handsome one to boot. Whereas, when he was living in the lower social strata, there in Kansas City and Chicago, girls wouldn't even look twice at him. But here he presents himself as a man of means, and the very first person he meets looks up at him and gets all soft in the knees. I'll see if he's in, she replied, much more civilly, and plugging at the same time a switch which led to Mr. Gilbert Griffith's private office. Word coming back to her, apparently, that Mr. Gilbert Griffiths was busy at the moment and could not be disturbed, she called back. It's Mr. Gilbert's cousin, Mr. Clyde Griffiths. He has a letter from Mr. Samuel Griffiths. Then she said to Clyde, won't you sit down? I'm sure Mr. Gilbert Griffiths will see you in a moment. He's busy just now. And Clyde, noting the unusual deference paid him, a form of deference that never in his life before had been offered him, was strangely moved by it. To think that he should be a full cousin to this wealthy and influential family, this enormous factory, so long and wide and high as he had seen six stories, and walking along the opposite side of the river just now, he had seen through several open windows whole rooms full of girls and women hard at work, and he had been thrilled in spite of himself. For somehow, the high red walls of the building suggested energy and very material success, a type of success that was almost without flaw as he saw it. Take a moment to just digest that for a second because, you know, when I was living in the wilds of Connecticut, in our town, there was a factory, an old factory called the Gilbert and Bennett Wire Factory. It was formed around probably this time or a bit earlier to manufacture wire, of all things. And Gilbert and Bennett had this whole big factory exactly as described in An American Tragedy, almost entirely made of brick. Full windows, enormous, probably about six or seven stories high, and it also enclosed a whole little village of supporting buildings and outbuildings and factories, as well as worker housing that was all kind of set up in surrounding the factory. So it was a whole little factory village that, well, you know, they're not making wire there anymore. The factory had fallen on hard times. I'm guessing by the 60s, maybe even earlier, had been abandoned. It was a brownfield, meaning there was all kinds of environmental degradation and such that occurred there. And it has remained unoccupied for decades, despite numerous plans to revive it and turn it into all kinds of, you know, whatever, housing and commercial development and parks and theaters and blah, blah, blah. Well, bullshit, nothing ever happened there. So when I hear about this factory out there in Lycurgus, I'm just imagining the future, not a handful of decades hence, when collar manufacturing is, you know, off ship to Bangladesh and China and Vietnam and Mexico and Guatemala and all these less expensive nations. And those are the industrial challenges. The next generation, or I guess two generations from Clydes, will face. But we've got Clyde there circling the kind of Ayn Randian dreamscape of what capitalism can achieve. And he's seeing it right now through those rose-tinted glasses that he has strapped to his face because he's, you know, he's looking at his own future and feeling optimistic. But Dreiser, just in that line at the end there, he says, a type of success that was almost without flaw, comma, as he saw it. In other words, Dreiser, with those four words, is editorializing a little bit. We already know that Clyde is weak of character, according to Dreiser, and perhaps his infatuation with all that capitalism can produce in Dreiser's mind is also a flaw in his character, because he suggests that the factory itself is without flaw. And we all know, those of us who know anything about the history of labor in this nation and world, that factories aren't all they're cracked up to be. He looked at the gray plaster walls of this outer waiting chamber, at some lettering on the inner door, which read, "The Griffiths Collar and Shirt Company, Incorporated, Samuel Griffiths, President, Gilbert Griffiths, Secretary," and wondered what it was all like inside, what Gilbert Griffiths would be like, cold or genial, friendly or unfriendly. And then, as he sat there meditating, the woman suddenly turned to him and observed, "You can go in now. Mr. Gilbert Griffith's office is at the extreme rear of this floor over toward the river. Any one of the clerks inside will show you." She half rose as if to open the door for him, but Clyde, sensing the intent, brushed by her. "Well, that's all right, thanks," he said, most warmly. In opening the glass-plated door, he gazed upon a room housing many over 100 employees, chiefly young men and young women. And all were apparently intent on their duties before them. Most of them had green shades over their eyes. Quite all of them had on short alpaca office coats or sleeve protectors over their shirt sleeves. Nearly all of the young women wore clean and attractive gingham dresses or office slips. And all about this central space, which was partitionless and supported by round white columns, were offices labeled with the names of the various minor officials and executives of the company: Mr. Smilly, Mr. Latch, Mr. Gotboy, Mr. Berkey. I mean, I gotta say, it sounds kind of nice in there. Yeah, look, if you're going to work at a collar factory, I sort of like the bright, open, airy floor plan. You know, very modern. There's no cubicles there. It's not dehumanizing. You get your own green eye shade and you get your own sleeve protector or office slip. Wow. I bet that's a Randy Young office. Over 100 young men and women milling about in their sharp clothes, their gingham dresses, their pressed trousers and such, probably flirting with each other quietly under their breaths while the bosses mill around on the perimeter of that great facility. Since the telephone girl had said that Mr. Gilbert Griffiths was at the extreme rear, Clyde, without much hesitation, made his way along the railed-off aisle to that quarter, where upon a half-open door he read, "Mr. Gilbert Griffiths, Secretary." He paused, uncertain whether to walk in or not, and then proceeded to tap. At once, a sharp, penetrating voice called, "Come!" And he entered, and faced a youth who looked, if anything, smaller and a little older, and certainly much colder and shrewder than himself. Such a youth, in short, as Clyde would have liked to imagine himself to be, trained in an executive sense, apparently authoritative and efficient. He was dressed, as Clyde noted at once, in a bright gray suit of a very pronounced pattern, for it was once more approaching spring. His hair, of a lighter shade than Clyde's, was brushed and glazed most smoothly back from his temples and forehead, and his eyes, which Clyde, from the moment he had opened the door, had felt drilling him, were of a clear, liquid, grayish-green blue. He had on a pair of large, horn-rimmed glasses, which he wore at his desk only, and the eyes that peered through them went over Clyde swiftly and notatively, from his shoes to the round, brown felt hat which he carried in his hand. I love this, and I will tell you why. I've mentioned this before, but Dreiser does this thing I feel like I've never seen another author do, or maybe I just never really paid attention to it, but he has this deft little literary trick he does. So we go in there, right? We're following Clyde. Clyde had gone to the office. Clyde had said to the telephone girl, "Hey, where the hell is my cousin?" The telephone girl had told him. He walks back through the bullpen. He reaches the office. He sees Gilbert. He starts describing Gilbert, right? He had on, okay, so he's talking about his hair. He's talking about his suit and his dress. And then he says, he had on a pair of large horn-rimmed glasses, which he wore at his desk only. That's the key right there. Because it's almost like a key change in a song. Because he is kind of subtly changing the perspective. Because Clyde, of course, would not know that he only wore them at his desk. And so we're going from Clyde's mind for a moment into the omniscient mind of the narrator and then into the mind of Gilbert Griffiths himself. Listen to this. He had on a pair of large horn-rimmed glasses, which he wore at his desk only, right? And the eyes that peered through them. So now we are in Gilbert's perspective. Went over Clyde swiftly and notatively, from his shoes to the round brown felt hat which he carried in his hand. So the entire perspective has changed. It's just a neat little do-si-do, a literary do-si-do. I like that. "You're my cousin, I believe," he commented rather icily as Clyde came forward and stopped, a thin and certainly not very favorable smile playing about his lips. "Yes, I am," replied Clyde, reduced and confused by this calm and rather freezing reception. On the instant, as he now saw, and now we're back with Clyde, he could not possibly have the same regard and esteem for this cousin as he could and did have for his uncle, whose very great ability had erected this important industry. Rather, deep down in himself, he felt that this young man, an heir, and nothing more to this great industry, was taking to himself airs and superiorities which, but for his father's skill before him, would not have been possible. And I think we'll leave it there, but that is interesting. I overused that word, interesting. That is notable, remarkable, that within the first moment of meeting his cousin, he has assessed him with a fairly critical and acute eye. This Clyde Griffiths, who is but a hayseed from the outskirts of the nation, has traveled here to this industrial home, nothing but a brown felt hat in his hand, and yet this hayseed has ascertained correctly his cousin's attitude toward him and his own attitude toward his cousin, whom he seems to hold in less respect only a moment after meeting him than he did while approaching the office, that respect having dwindled because of his cousin's chilly reception to him and him saying, "Well, fuck you, dude. Like, what did you ever do? Nothing. You were born into this shit. I worked my way to get here. I had to cajole and wheedle. I had to kill a girl in Kansas City. And here you are, looking at me through those horn-rimmed glasses like you're my better. F off, dude." So, Yeah, we'll leave it there. It's I like the little dynamic that's getting set up. I like that he didn't really beat around the bush with it. Gil came in, looked at his cousin and said, look at this fucking hayseed. And Clyde looked at his cousin and said, look at this fucking snob. It's just a real upstairs, downstairs kind of thing. You know, almost a Freaky Friday. We're heading towards a body switching movie where the poor guy's going to learn about the rich guy and the rich guy's going to learn about the poor guy. Rich mouse, city mouse, country mouse, that sort of thing. A lot of fun. It's a well-worn, it's well-worn literary territory, but to heck with it. I enjoy it every time. And we will pick it up again on another phantasmagorical, not really, episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu. This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and the great Robin Lynn. Our theme song is by Craig Wedren. We rely on you, the listeners, for support. So please, go to patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack, sign up. There's all kinds of fun stuff. There's goodies. You could join the book club where we get together. We talk about the book that we're reading. And it's just a fun community. So, you know, head on over to patreon.com/MichaelIanBlack, and I will see you next time.